to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You have the very latest episode of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Nice going. And nice going on the part of these great listeners who support this program with American dollars. Patricia Player, Kathleen Lowy, Michael Gill, Jeffrey Adair. Thank you for your voluntary subscriptions. If you haven't supported the show, you're able and you'd like to, I welcome it. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. Here comes the second installment in a three-part series of the Boiling Frogs interview episodes, co-hosted with Sybelle Edmonds. Our focus is on the CIA on campus. And Professor Stephen Solds is about to tell you about the role that psychologists have played in the recent use of torture in the American Gulag, and particularly the sordid role of the American Psychological Association in condoning the participation of its members in these illegal and unethical practices. Thanks for listening, and feel free to share this far and wide. Put it up on Facebook and like it. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sybelle Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins, and this is the second in our series, drawn from the new book, The CIA on Campus. You heard our first installment with the editor and major contributor to the book, Philip Zwirling. And joining us today is another individual who contributed an essay to this important new book. He is Stephen Solds, S-O-L-D-Z, and he's director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. He is also one of the members and a past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. And for many years now, he has been outspoken regarding issues related to the profession of psychology and the use of psychologists and their skills in the U.S. government's programs of enhanced interrogation, which we regard as torture. Stephen Solds, welcome to our program today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, I appreciate your work, and I want to alert our listeners that a little bit later in our conversation, we are going to ask for their support on an important new petition drive that you and colleagues have launched. Stephen Solds, before I get into some questions about the essay that you wrote and the work that you've done, tell me in a broad sense what your concerns are, in particular about the role of psychologists in the more aggressive form of militarism and in particular the torture programs that were initiated by George W. Bush?
Well, as you know, it's now incontrovertible that the U.S. engaged in a program of abusive war on terror detainees that in which they used techniques that had traditionally been denounced by our government, by the State Department, among others, as torture, under this name, as you called it, as you referred, the enhanced interrogation techniques. A fair amount is known about the role of the lawyers in providing a legal rationale for this program and redefining torture so that torture didn't mean torture, but torture meant whatever the U.S. government doesn't do. But what is less known is that the other profession who played a central role in this was psychologists, that it was psychologists who designed the enhanced interrogation techniques, who, at least in the early stages of the CIA part of the program, because there was the CIA and Defense Department, which were somewhat separate, the CIA part was implemented by psychologists on the infamous videotapes of enhanced interrogations that were destroyed. Mm-hmm. It's believed that it was psychologists who was on those videotapes. They trained other interrogators to use these torture techniques, and psychologists, we'll probably get into this later, played a central role in providing legal protection for torturers.
Mm-hmm. And in my view, based on the research and some of the careful articles that have been written about this, we cross some very critical lines, even up to the point of actually conducting live experiments on human beings. Because we know that one of the early recipients of these tactics was Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded tens of times. And we know that his interrogation was being micromanaged by remote control from the National Security Council, and that in real time they were communicating with the individuals who were administering the waterboarding and other torture techniques to Abu Zubaydah. And the role that psychologists played, apparently, was in trying to find the range, the tolerance of this human subject as to how long they could deprive him of oxygen and put him through this fake drowning scenario without actually killing him. And so I'd like you to talk about that, because I think that's one of the most significant departures from what we consider to be American standards of the past.
Yeah, well, last year, Physicians for Human Rights issued a report, which I was a co-author, Experiments in Torture, Evidence of Research and Human Subject Experimentation in the Enhanced Interrogation Program. And what we documented in there using official government documents was that in addition to this, to the enhanced interrogation programs, as they were implementing it, they were very carefully studying it, as you were indicating there, including very detailed documentation of, for example, of how much water was used, what was the pH of the water, what angle the person was lying on the board that is used for waterboarding, and many other factors. And as a result of that, they changed the procedures which they did it. Now, this meets the federal government's own definition of research, which is the collection of data for the purpose of creating generalizable knowledge, namely knowledge that they were going to use in torturing other detainees. So this was a central part, presumably done by health professionals, the research. We're assuming psychologists were part of that. There's also evidence, but it's a little more circumstantial, that there was a much broader research program going on, and we have only the glimmerings of it, but there are indications that data was collected in other places regularly. There was also, as we'll probably talk about, as I talk about in this chapter in the book, there was an extensive program that the federal government was stimulating among among academic psychologists that fit together with this on so-called deception detection, the detection of deception. And the way we know that's connected is that this program, early in this program, there were conferences between the American Psychological Association, the APA, which is the largest association of psychologists in the world, in fact, of any mental health organization in the world, and the CIA, along with the RAND Corporation, one of those government contractors who does lots of classified research. And at this meeting were the psychologists who designed and implemented the enhanced interrogation program. They tried to hide the agenda and the attendance list, but we have that.
That would be
enhanced interrogations there.
That would be James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, to be explicit.
And their CIA boss, Kirk Hubbard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the head of the American Psychological Association in this time period is Joseph Matarazzo, or Matarazzo?
Matarazzo was president of the APA a long time ago in the 1980s.
Oh, okay.
He has a long-time APA connection. He was on the board of the company that Mitchell and Jessen, the CIA's torture psychologists, they created a private consulting company, Mitchell Jessen Associates, mm-hmm. and on the board was Joseph Matarazzo, former APA president.
And so one of the things that you and other colleagues have done is challenge the leadership of the APA, the American Psychological Association, over the ethical conflict that is evident in their collusion with the Central Intelligence Agency. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, and the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that from early on, as early as late 2001, they were going to the administration, and in some ways it's understandable. As one human rights colleague of mine said, after 9/11, I would have done anything I was asked, but he soon woke up. They never woke up. And so they offered their services. We know that there were these conferences on deception detection. We know that there were a number of meetings at which Mitchell and Jessen and sometimes Kirk Hubbard were present with prominent psychologists who had APA connections, were either president or had other positions. We know that the APA has regularly bragged about their close ties to the CIA and other intelligence agencies. They are very proud of those ties. They're very proud of placing psychologists as fellows in these intelligence agencies where they do things like study deception detection, and they help coordinate academic psychologists working with so-called operational psychologists, those involved in the operations of the intelligence agencies, namely torture and psyops and other activities that psychologists are involved in.
And so, Dr. Solds, in your article, you make a pretty stunning allegation against the president of the APA, Martin Seligman. You say that he attended meetings where interrogation tactics were discussed, and then that he personally, or a company that he's involved with, was awarded a $31 million no-bid contract by the Army to conduct some training of soldiers. This appears to be a very serious and deep personal conflict of interest.
Well, I want to be very clear on what we're claiming, Dr. Seligman, who is one of the most prominent psychologists, developer of the so-called theory of learned helplessness, and most recently of positive psychology, that he met with Mitchell and Jessen and Kirk Hubbard several times is now incontrovertible. There was a meeting in his home. I believe it was January of 2002, though it could have been, I don't remember the exact month.
Well, let me help you here because you I have the book open.
Okay.
In December 2001, 3 months after the 9/11 attacks, Seligman hosted a meeting of the Psychology of Capitulation at his home, inviting academics and personnel from intelligence agencies, including the FBI, CIA, and Israeli intelligence. You go on, Kirk Hubbard, a top CIA psychologist, then working on setting up the Enhanced Interrogation Program, and James Mitchell, soon to be principal of Mitchell, Jessen, and Associates, participated. And reportedly, during a break, Mitchell lavished praise upon Seligman's theory of learned helplessness.
Yes, the source for that, by the way, is the New York Times.
Okay.
Seligman admits that meeting occurred. Later in the spring, around April, Seligman spoke at a so-called SEER school. SEER is the Military Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, in which U.S. service members who are in danger of being captured by, quote, a power that does not respect the Geneva Convention, namely a power that tortures, in which U.S. servicemen are trained to resist breaking under this torture through a sort of what's viewed as an inoculation program where they're subjected to a few days of relatively moderate torture techniques.
Understood.
This SEER program was the basis of the enhanced interrogation techniques. Mitchell and Jessen were both psychologists with the SEER program. And so what they did is reverse engineer these inoculation techniques to try and break people down. So Seligman goes in April and speaks at the SEER school arranged by Kirk Hubbard of the CIA. Interesting, because Kirk Hubbard is not, it's the SEER school is under the military, Kirk Hubbard is CIA, so it's a little odd that he's arranging that meeting. And Mitchell and Jessen were in the audience, as Dr. Seligman admits. Now, he tells us that they did not discuss the applications of learned helplessness to the enhanced interrogation program because they told him he didn't have a security clearance and they couldn't discuss it. Which is a very odd statement, if you think about it. Namely, they told you we can't discuss how we might use this in the interrogation program because you're not cleared to know it. That seems to be of saying, well, we are thinking about that. Sure should have been a warning to anybody with their eyes open that maybe they were thinking about using this in the interrogation program. And even if it wasn't clear at that point in 2002 what it was, when word later that year started coming out about what the CIA was up to, certainly Dr. Seligman should have been alerted that his lecture may not have been innocent. There's also now a report of a third meeting that he had with Mitchell, I think in March of 2002. And one of the things that's striking is this keeps on being dragged out of him. He, you know, only admits what the reporters have already discovered, and then turns out there's another meeting and another meeting. So one wonders, is there anything else to hide?
And tell us a little bit more about this $31 million no-bid contract awarded by the Army to Dr. Seligman.
Yeah, so the contract was for something called the development of an Army program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, which applies Dr. Seligman's so-called positive psychology, which at its best is an emphasis on human strengths rather than, as he would argue, other psychologists emphasize human weaknesses more. But so the idea is that this positive psychology will be used to, again, inoculate U.S. troops against trauma in combat through emphasizing strength, things like, I'm committed to the mission, my job is important, enhancing a sense of spirituality. There's been controversy about whether this is breaking the church-state barrier. Some atheist troops have challenged it on that basis. But so Dr. Seligman and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania were given this contract, this $31 million contract, to develop this program on a no-bid basis. Now, the military says that it was no-bid for two reasons. One, that there was this great research base for it, Now, when you read the research cited by the by Seligman and colleagues, the argument that it's a strong research base. I'm a research psychologist, among other things. I'm a clinician and researcher. Research base is weak at best. It's mainly with middle school and college students, far cry from soldiers in combat. And it actually didn't work as a preventative. It only worked for people who were already at high risk of depression. And we have two types of prevention programs. Those that sort of we apply to everybody, like smoking prevention programs, where we sort of, get every kid. We tell them the problems with smoking and try and delegitimate smoking. And then there are prevention programs aimed at those who are at high risk for a behavior. And their own results showed that it only worked for those at high risk for depression and anxiety among these middle school and college students.
And Dr. Soltz, with respect for the details of the research, the real stunner here is that there appears to be a payback, a quid pro quo.
I'm not asking you to make that allegation. I'm saying that there's questions that should be asked.
Well, beyond that. Let me frame it this way, that Dr. Seligman appeared to not only collaborate in his role as president of the APA with the defense and CIA aspects of our government in developing this new torture program, and it appears that he has been rewarded for the work that he's done. And the other aspect of this that you're most familiar with is that he has turned a stone wall to you and others who are members of APA who have challenged the collaboration and should be, I don't know if you have, but should be raising important questions about this no-bid contract he's been awarded.
Yeah, they've just referred it basically to the military.
And has there been any pushback from members of APA other than your group?
On the contract or on the general issue?
Well, let's say both, one at a time.
on the contract, no.
Mm-hmm.
There's a suggestion we got, actually just saw today, in something we wrote a critique of this comprehensive soldier fitness program, and just saw today a response from Dr. Seligman to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an indication he cites the Defense Department's reply to questions from Congress. So we're not sure. We don't have that actual document. We just have the quotes that he provides, but suggests that Congress asked some of the questions about the CSF that we asked, not necessarily mm-hmm. about whether it was a payback, but about other issues.
All right. Now, let me ask you a broader question here about the description that you offer in the article, because it's consistent with other reporting, and what I'm driving at here is the idea that the SEER program, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, that this was reverse engineered in order to produce the aggressive tactics that amount to torture that Donald Rumsfeld authorized to be used at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And I'm curious about this because I'm not doubting your contention or the work of reporters like Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, who first wrote about the use of the SEER program to reverse engineer these techniques. The reason I raise questions and I'm slightly skeptical is that it seems that we never got out of the torture business. We know that after the exposure of the Church Committee and the Pike Committee in the 1970s, that the CIA purportedly cleaned up its act. But the School of the Americas remained open all through that time, and it was the device that we used to export America's knowledge and techniques of torture to Central and South America in the 1980s. So my question is, did we ever get out of the torture business, and why did we have to start from scratch and reverse engineer the SEER programs when it appears that we had active elements of our government that were teaching people torture at that time?
That's a good question, and it's a bit of a mystery. Here's my best guess, and it is a bit of a guess. People in the intelligence agencies or with connections there say that to a fair degree in the 1990s, especially in the Clinton administration, the U.S. basically got out of the torture business. We don't really know what's going on in School of the Americas during that time period. In the 1980s, it's clear. The documentation basically dries up around then. And to how detailed the work was, there certainly was cooperation with torturing regimes elsewhere through the rendition program where people were flown to other countries to be tortured or allegedly to be interrogated and not tortured, but we know that the countries were always ones where people would be tortured. And probably U.S. Special Forces in various capacities. But it does appear that direct involvement in the mechanics of torture, the U.S. was largely out of for a period in the 90s, and that therefore the chain of expertise may have been broken there, and that the place where the expertise was kept was the SEER program. That's the best sense I can get, because we have it. It is extensively documented now in many documents and official reports, as well as reporters, and long before Leopold and Kay, by the way, that the SEER program was the basis of the enhanced interrogation program.
And Dr. Soltz, in your research, have you come up with any information that links the 1950s CIA work under MK Ultra and other programs? You reference it in your article, and you also in the footnotes indicate that one of your sources was H.P. Alborelli's book called A Terrible Mistake, which is a highly detailed look at our chemical and biological weapons programs coming out of World War II. And we know that they experimented with LSD as a weapon and also as a kind of truth serum. And we know that getting the truth out of people was a driving focus of the efforts after 9/11 inside our government. So do you have any knowledge that we used medications, that we used chemicals or biological agents in order to try to open people up under interrogation?
This has been a major source of investigation, and it's unclear. The detainees at Guantanamo report being given mysterious drugs with psychological effects.
Are you referring to the anti-malarial agent?
No, separate from the anti-malarial. I was going to refer to that in a moment.
Okay, go ahead.
Separate from the anti-malarial agent. So there have been reports. The Washington Post reported on what the Guantanamo detainees. There allegedly was an inspector general's report within the CIA, which has never been made public on this issue, so we don't know what they found. So this is one of those mysteries there as to the extent of what drugging. I have heard from sources that drugs were given to the detainees as a group as sort of sedatives when they were afraid of riots, for example. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the anti-malarial drug that was given to new detainees there brought from Afghanistan, which the questions have been raised about whether whether it was an appropriate drug, whether the doses were out of whack. Certainly, the physicians I've talked to certainly believe that it was malpractice. As to whether it was something other than malpractice remains unknown.
And in that same vein, what about the suppositories? We know that every inmate who was grabbed and put on a plane for Guantanamo went through a ritual where they were essentially put into a straitjacket, they were gagged, they were earmuffed, and blindfolded, usually with a hood over their heads, and every one of them got an anal suppository, but we don't know what that was for.
Well, the presumption has always been there was a sedative of some type for control purposes. I don't know otherwise, and when I haven't seen the detainees reporting psychotropic effects other than sedation on those flights.
Okay, thank you. Sibel?
Yes, and forgive me for not sounding really academic. I have several degrees, and one of them actually is in psychology. But my questions tend to be coming from an angle of you know, the laymen out there who are listening to this, because a lot of things sound so familiar. You know, we went through all these Hollywood productions of how Germans were experimenting, and the doctors from the, you know, the medical doctors and the psychologists, they participated. And one question that always popped up for us, the people, the regular average people outside the academia, is, well, what got those people and lured them into participation? And that's the part of psychology I really would like to know, and that is, with these recruitments, with these participations, if you look at from the perspective of the psychology of those who participated in this and still continue to participate, whether these people are the psychologists or the teachers within the academia, or the management and the high-level people within the APA, what... especially with what we know today and what has come out in terms of all the torture programs, everything that we have done, what is their mind frame, that the psychologist says, I participate in this and this is how I justify it, both emotionally but also intellectually in terms of the ethics?
Well, what we've been told by people in the intelligence community, operatives, they say that basically academics are the easiest people to manipulate. All you have to do is stoke their ego a bit and they'll do anything you want. And I think that that's part of it. I suspect for the APA leadership, it's a mixture of patriotism, their sense that this is good for the profession by both opening up opportunities and by creating goodwill, say, from the Bush administration, so that Bush administration wouldn't oppose psychology and other initiatives, for example, psychology's role in Medicare. It's also this business about feeling important and hanging out. I think they loved hanging out with these generals and these spies. You know, you just feel like you're an important person. You're in the inner group. You're not in the outer group. And so for those people, for the academics doing academic research, there's always this complex thing, which is what we learned from MKUltra, where hundreds and hundreds of scientists, psychologists, and other social scientists and others were involved, 180 universities. For the academics, I think it's some of the same business about wanting to be important. But there's another side of it, which is, well, there's two other sides of it, which we learned about from MKUltra, where hundreds of scientists, psychologists primarily, but other social scientists and biological scientists, physicians, were involved in research that, when all put together, is horrendous. Some of the things that people did then were awful, and some were not. But when you're playing with the security agencies, the problem is you don't know the full picture. So you can be doing innocuous research, but you don't know the purposes to which they want to put it. The purposes may be decent ones or maybe not, but it provides protection for you. It also makes it easy for those who want to manipulate to do it, because the person can just say, well, I'm just studying this little area, and it's of interest to me. Then the other part of it is money. They dangled money in front of people. So I've heard reports from people who were at those APA, CIA meetings, that some of the people there who were top behavioral science researchers were coming up with what was described as basically like crap, because they thought that the CIA would fund it, because all of a sudden there was money available for this type of research. And unfortunately, one of the things in academia that is so corrupting is the pressure to get grants means that people will do a lot for money. We discovered this with the pharmaceutical companies. for all kinds of, in addition to good research, crap research occurs because the pharmaceutical companies will fund it. So you've got this mixture of egoism, being important, patriotism, and sort of rank-and-file corruption of chasing funding and money and not worrying too much what the real purposes are and where the work is going to go to.
Okay, so if we were to compare to what many Americans are familiar with, again, thanks to Hollywood, with all the Gestapo-related movies that they have put out there, we have at least three of those elements present, or we had them present with, let's say, Germany under Hitler. And when the scientists and the academics and those medical professions, you know, those people, they participated in those programs, they were driven by patriotism because they called it, you know, it was nationalism, it was patriotism, and also the egoism that you mentioned, minus the dollar elements, because I don't know if Hitler under Gestapo, they were providing all these lucrative millions of dollars worth of contracts to those people who participated in those, you know, torture, interrogation, both psychological and physical programs in Germany. So would that be the only difference in general if we look at it?
Well, I think it's partly consistent with the banality of evil. Certainly, I would not want to equate the research done in the CIA to the research done in the Nazis.
Why not?
I don't. I think it has some of the same characteristics, but it was not of the magnitude of the kind of work that was done there, or at least anything that we know publicly.
Yeah.
But on part of this, let me read, actually, because we were talking about Marty Seligman's before, his what I just saw today, his response to our critique of comprehensive soldier fitness on patriotism, because it closes with this paragraph exactly on that. Second, Idelson et al. Accused us of a quote, blind embrace of simple notions of patriotism, unquote. While my patriotism is not blind, I view the United States as the country that gave my grandparents, persecuted unto death in Europe, a safe haven where their children and grandchildren would flourish. I view the U.S. Army as the force that stood between me and the Nazi gas chambers, and thus I count my days with the sergeants and the generals as the most fulfilling of my life. So I think it gives both the sense of, in some sense, the identification with the U.S. government and with the military and intelligence agencies as the protectors of the American way of life, and also uses the same kind of us them reasoning that was there. In this case, the Nazis or the terrorists are the them, just as for the Nazis, of course, it was the Jews who were the them, and that's a great danger.
Well, that's interesting, because we also know that it was interesting that you mentioned the Mossad Israeli intelligence, at least participants in these programs. But again, it's very interesting, the parallels, because when you see the wide and use of torture and these types of research in Israel coming from the same people who are only two generations or three generations away from what they went through with the... then you kind of arrive, it seems like a different conclusion, you know, similar to saying, well, those people who, or many who get, tend to be abused sexually, et cetera, they tend to be abusers, if, you know, and would that make sense then, let's say, for Israel? We are looking for the Jewish people who are removed by two, three generations from what their grandparents went through, and yet what they are doing and implementing in Israel. And again, this is what, under the guise of patriotism and nationalism and the great Israel, what is the justification?
And also the ideology of the victimology. You know, one of the sad things that we have in the Middle East is a fight for who's the victim. The identification is victim. And we have it here. 9/11 led the United States, U.S. citizens, to feel like victims of this horrific jihadist movement. And unfortunately, identification as victim can be double-edged and can be blinding to reality.
Another question I have is, how widespread is it, you know, those people who participate, whether or not there exists any conformity element in this? Would you say, when it comes to these programs, most of these people are open in participating within the, you know, academics and, you know, APA, the psychologists there in participating directly or indirectly in working with government with similar programs? Or would you say they tend to be the minority? Most people, or most of these people within the academia, the psychologists, they tend not to participate or have anything to do with it. I just want to see whether or not there exists any kind of a conformity, since most of those people, they are open to it, then because, you know, there is this element of conformity.
Well, most people aren't given the opportunity to participate. If one would have to look, for example, at Defense Department funding, where there's enormous amounts of funding, and people will take that. In terms of the CIA work, only a small number are given the opportunity. What is sad is the closing of eyes that occur among so many. I mean, we've been talking about this for years, writing about it. I think I've written 80 or more publications on the roles of psychologists in torture just myself, and there are many others who do it. And yet there are so many colleagues who claim to know, who have never heard of it, colleagues who claim to be concerned about social justice, and yet basically, see, the APA has created this cover story, which is that psychologists are protecting detainees, that they're against torture, they're protecting them from being tortured. And basically, what's scary is how easily that cover story has been bought by so many people within the profession without being open, even when we've spent years and years and the press has provided article after article after article, provided contrary evidence. So many people, like on the Council of Representatives of the APA, almost nobody will raise any questions. If the APA says, we're against torture, they all say, oh, wonderful, we're against torture. And the fact that there's other evidence, it just doesn't figure. We even got responses from members of council when we've emailed them to say, how dare you write to me? There's a sort of willful looking the other way. You know, it's somewhat reminiscent of the people who lived near the concentration camps, and there was an odd smell. Oh, it never occurred to me. I never thought about what that smell was from. But now, you know, years later, now that you mention it, yeah, that was odd, wasn't it?
Right. For some reason, I so identify with you and what you're saying, because I've been known for the past 10 years, I have been living with this title of whistleblower, government whistleblower.
Yes.
And I have, through our organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, with the CIA, FBI whistleblowers, one of the first questions we are asked when we are being interviewed by the media, et cetera, is, so what made you blow the whistle? You know, as if we have done something extraordinary when all of us, when we did what we did in terms of coming forward and raising awareness and reporting the issue, was we thought we were doing the right thing, what we were supposed to be doing. We never thought of it as whistleblowing. And reading the book, you know, what you have written with Dr. Zwirling and your other colleagues, I mean, based on their assessment, the media, basically you are whistleblowers. You are whistleblowers. They were coming forward and saying, this is wrong, and here's why it's wrong, and here's why it should stop. And you are the minority. I call it the vigilant minority. Do you view yourself in a way, you and your colleagues, with what you have been doing here, as in a way, because it's defined in so many different ways, as whistleblowing, blowing the whistle?
Certainly, though, I don't want to claim we haven't taken the risk that, say, you did and other more classical whistleblowers have. I mean, there's been moments which have been scary, and there's been possible professional consequences, but certainly wouldn't want to claim that we were tried in the way that, say, you were tried.
Dr. Soltz, just a couple of comments on your exchange here with Sibel in the last few minutes. First of all, I find it ironic and offensive that Dr. Seligman would play the Holocaust card in an effort to divert attention from his own role in facilitating the new torture program in the United States over the past 10 years. I just find that personally offensive. Secondly, Russell Tice, an NSA whistleblower who has appeared with us on this podcast twice, in his most recent conversation with us, he underscored that the NSA purported to protect journalists from the pervasive wiretapping and email interception program that was launched after 9/11, which clearly violates the Fourth Amendment and was a violation of the FISA law before they fixed that. And what Tice told us was that he and others were informed that there were special protocols to make sure that journalists were protected from the massive dragnet that the NSA had set up. And Tice revealed to us that, in fact, that was the way they were targeting journalists, and that the two individuals, Lichtblau and Risen, the reporters at the New York Times who ultimately exposed this massive wiretapping program, but a year after they should have, they waited until 2005 after Bush had been given a second term. And in the process, they were wiretapped and their conversations with Russell Tice were presumably intercepted. And so with that in mind, when I hear that members of the APA believe that the role of the APA and psychologists has been to protect the subjects of the torture program, well, it just rang as hollow as the NSA's protection of journalists.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, we now know that that whole ideology of psychologists' protection derives directly from the Bush Justice Department torture memos, that health psychologists and other health professionals were protecting detainees, because if a psychologist said that the definition of psychological torture as under the Bush definition meant it had to cause severe, long-lasting harm. And what the memo said is, if a health professional tells you that it will not cause severe, long-lasting harm, then you couldn't have had the intent to cause severe, long-lasting harm, even though, of course, you knew it would.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that they were protectors, and that's where that language comes from. The APA repeats over and over again that that psychologists have a vital role to play in keeping interrogations safe, legal, ethical, and effective. That phrase is a mantra of theirs. Now, that language they took directly from the instructions to the behavioral science consultants at Guantanamo that they were given by the person who wrote them. And those instructions were, that part of it was taken directly from the torture memos.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been echoing the torture memos, and since these memos are now public and have been for several years, they should have known, there's no basis, there's no justification for their pretense anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's not just a pretense, unfortunately.
Dr. Soltz, in your article in the book, The CIA on Campus, you relate an anecdote about a psychologist named Martha Davis, and we'll exclude her. She's not the former lead singer of the rock group called The Motels. But Davis spent...
She is a filmmaker. She's got a film called Doctors of the Dark Side coming out very soon.
Oh, okay. Interesting. You cite that she spent 40 years studying nonverbal behavior and over a decade investigating cues to deception, and that she used that in police work, helped consult with the NYPD, but that after a meeting with the CIA and the RAND Corporation... she became a critic of the EPA and suspended her research. Tell us a little bit more about Dr. Martha Davis.
Well, she, as you say, she consulted for years to the NYPD, but it was on general strategies for detecting deception. It was not consulting on individual cases. She felt very clearly that that was that would be unethical, that that was not her role as a psychologist to teach general knowledge about how deception is manifest. She felt it was okay, so she went to that meeting. She was invited to the meeting as many researchers on deception detection were, and was rather frightened by what she saw there. There were many CIA operatives whose names were not given, who were not on the attendance list. There was apparently, I believe, a sort of separate meeting another day of those people who would play ball, and she felt that they were oblivious to the ethical concerns that needed to be put in place very strongly. So she became a severe critic and argued that psychologists cannot participate in interrogations. That if you participate in interrogations, you're not a psychologist. You're an intelligence agent and intelligence operative, and that there should be an iron wall between the two businesses.
And Dr. Solds, do we have a problem now where this whole set of issues is creeping into university curricula? You have a section here in your article called National Security Psychology, and it suggests that the government is moving to kind of build permanent assets in the academic community for these kinds of questionable processes and policies.
Yeah, so, and that's part of what the book is about, is the ways in which the intelligence agencies are building these ties between academics and intelligence operatives. One of the problems is that these ties are often covert. They're not known to all the people involved. So we don't know the extent of it. It's talked about, we learned later from MKUltra how hundreds and hundreds of people were involved. They said something like 180 universities, though the names of most of those researchers and most of those universities were never revealed and were able to be kept secret. It was considered it would be embarrassing to the universities to have their names listed. So we know a number of them, almost every prominent university in the country. So we don't know. We have a tip of the iceberg. I'm able to document a little bit where we got some evidence, but there's probably a lot more going on. And how this influences the professions, we don't know. Who's involved wittingly? Who's involved unwittingly? Through as an MKUltra, where many people were involved unwittingly, funded by a mysterious foundation, the Foundation for Human Ecology, and not knowing, some of them knew that this was really the CIA. Many did not know, and who knows what's going on today? There's suggestions that some of the money for this was being funneled, for example, through the National Institutes of Mental Health. Some of the work on deception detection, and so how many people who are getting grants, traditional research grants from them, or maybe the National Science Foundation, are actually doing work that's funded indirectly through intelligence agencies, or is being chosen because of the interest to intelligence agencies. These are serious concerns, and they really undermine the traditional values of the university, the pursuit of knowledge, and the openness, which academic now pursuits are supposed to have. Unfortunately, those are being undermined also by the corporate ties that universities have these days. So increasingly, there's all kinds of secret agreements with corporations, etc.
Dr. Stoltz, do we have another agency's involvement with the academia, the psychologists there, and and the APA, and that is the Department of Homeland Security, because lately we have been reading about the new programs and upcoming programs dealing with pre-crime detection and you know, various questionnaires and watching for facial expressions, etc. Do we have similar types of, again, both
and
funding universities?
Yes.
And yes, please tell us a little bit about that.
The Department of Homeland Security funded a number of sort of centers for Homeland Security at major universities. Among other things, it sometimes appears to be payback for people. People who've sort of kept their mouth shut seem to mysteriously get funding for one of these centers. As Dana Priest documented recently, you know, the intelligence system is so enormous. I think she reported that there was 1,800 intelligence agencies in the country with something like over 800,000 people with top secret clearances, and with nobody in the entire country having a list of all the intelligence agencies. No one in Congress, not even the Director of National Intelligence. It's simply amazing with all of those agencies what in the world they're doing, and I'm sure many of them are dabbling in various ways in academia. In universities, the administrations are often hungry for money and willing to cut corners.
Dr. Solds, you are part of a group that has recently started to circulate a petition, and we are going to share this with our listeners here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. You're calling for an annulment of the American Psychological Association's 2005 report, and this is shorthand PENS, P-E-N-S. It stands for the Psychological Ethics and National Security Report that was made to the president of the APA in 2005. First of all, for background, what did this report say, and in practical terms, what did it enable? And then you can explain why you want to annul it.
Okay, well, the report was when news of health professionals, psychologists, and physicians in particular, involvement in the torture program became public, there was pressure on professional associations, the American Medical, the American Psychiatric, and the American Psychological Association. Let me just explain for your audience that psychiatrists are medical doctors who treat people with mental illness or emotional problems. Psychologists are non-medical doctors who have a degree in psychology, because many people are confused about the difference. So the medical doctors, the AMA and the psychiatrists, said their members it was not ethical for their members to participate in interrogations, period, because their role was healers. The American Psychological Association appointed this task force, the PENS task force, which said, they're the famous ones who said that psychologists have a vital role to play in keeping interrogations safe, legal, ethical, and effective. So this then allows the psychologist to remain involved in consulting to interrogation at Guantanamo, at the CIA black sites. And while it says that psychologists don't participate in torture, we know how meaningful that is under the Bush administration, when torture is defined as basically anything the United States government doesn't do. Effectively, what it did was it allowed both the fig leaf, the psychologists were protecting people, while it allowed them to function as intelligence operatives and remain involved in interrogation. Now, one of the issues with this is that it was a secret task force. They kept the membership secret from the membership of the APA and from the press for a year, until eventually a reporter, Mark Benjamin, obtained the names from Congress. And when the names were revealed, it turned out that 6 of the 10 members were from the military intelligence establishment. And 5 of those 6 had served in chains of command that had been accused of abuses. And I use that language very carefully, because we can't prove what any individual did. But, for example, One of them was at Guantanamo at a crucial time where a standard operating procedures mandating abusive use of isolation were put into effect. He was the chief intelligence psychologist there. It's implausible to believe he had nothing to do with creating those protocols, though we can't prove it. It's all classified. And so five of the people had been in chains of command accused of abuses, precisely those activities which this committee was supposed to judge whether they were ethical or not, and a sixth one, so a majority, were there. Then the leadership of the APA, who was present, rammed through support for the military's position, and various other procedural irregularities occurred. But keeping the membership secret in itself means this is invalid. I mean, when you a professional task force, legitimacy depends on who the members are. Or it depends on knowing who they are, that they're leaders who you trust.
And Dr. Soles, we can assume that since this was a presidential task force, that all of these individuals whose identities were at first secret were appointed by the same President Seligman who we've been talking about.
No. Seligman had been president before 9/11.
Okay.
There are a lot of APA presidents involved in this business. You're president for 1 year.
I see.
There are a lot of different presidents. Ron Levant was president at the time, and Gerald Kutcher was president-elect and was the board representative to the task force and was a very powerful presence there in silencing opposition.
Mm-hmm.
There were two members who voiced some concerns. For example, one of them pointed out that they hadn't conducted any investigation of what it was that the psychologists were doing at Guantanamo. So how could they decide if it was ethical if they didn't find out what was occurring? And he basically told her that if you want to do that, you should have stayed home. Even though the official mandate of the committee was to investigate what's the role of the psychologists at Guantanamo and other sites.
Mm-hmm.
So he also was adamant that they would that the task force would not endorse international law.
You have started to gather signatures for this petition, and we're going to put up a link to the petition from BoilingFrogsPost.com so that our listeners and readers can read your petition and, if they agree with it, add their names to the list of signatures. And then what do you plan to do with this? What is your strategy for trying to bring this to the attention of the leadership of the American Psychological Association?
Well, in some sense, the strategy is not to bring this to their attention. We've been doing that for 6 years now. The strategy is to make this a public scandal, that this is not just an issue for psychologists. We've had petitions with hundreds and hundreds of psychologists that have been completely ignored. We're saying if this is an issue for the public, do you want the person who may be treating you, who may be your therapist or your child's therapist, do you want to have to worry about what they were doing 10 years ago? Maybe they were torturing somebody. That this is not the way we want health professionals to behave, and that this is an interest for everybody. So we're trying to apply pressure from outside of, from psychologists, but also from outside the profession. So we're trying somewhat of a new strategy this time.
I just want to tell you that I respect you so very much, and this goes beyond just what we talked about here. It also goes to my own background and this issue being a really personal issue for me. My father, during Shah's regime, was tortured and interrogated by Savak, and the people who implemented those techniques on my dad, they were all trained by the CIA task force that was going through Iran every 2 years, and they were training all of them on these interrogation techniques and torture practices. So my father, he's a surgeon, he's a doctor, and they really couldn't break him, and he actually challenged the government in every opportunity that he faced and he got in life later. And as a doctor, he really took his Hippocratic Oath very, very seriously. In Turkey, for example, they have this law that if you saw as a doctor or came across any Kurdish person who was injured by bullet or knife, you had to immediately report it to the authorities. This is the Turkish intelligence service and the military intelligence service there. And my father was famous as a person there that many Kurdish wounded people could go to through the back door and get treated. So I really want to thank you, and I want to tell you that I respect you very, very much, and I'm proud of you.
Well, thank you. But that your story about your father's also shows the importance of upholding professional ethics, that he had that, the Hippocratic Oath, the do-no-harm ethic of the health profession, so internalized that he was willing to go beyond what the state allowed. And that's what we're saying for psychology, that psychologists need to stand on their ethics. The principle A of the American Psychological Association Ethics Code is psychologists strive to benefit those with whom they work and to do no harm. And we're trying to say that that do no harm standard has to be maintained, or we might as well give up the profession.
Dr. Stephen Solds from Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, a past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and a contributor to the new book, The CIA on Campus. We will continue our series on these issues here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. Thank you, Dr. Solds.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Give me absolute control over every living soul in the haversack, baby. That's an order. Take the only tree that's left. Stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me the back of a burning wall. Give me a star. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.